Adlai Stevenson was speaking up for freedom. Adlai Stevenson was speaking up for democracy, for all the Joe Smiths of the United States. Adlai Stevenson was saying to America, I trust you to make up your own mind. I trust democracy. I trust America. And so with pride I give you two uncommon men who speak for you and me, for all the 160 million uncommon Joe Smiths who make up America today, Adlai Stevenson of Illinois and Estes A. Key Faber of Tennessee.
Governor, leader, Senator Key Faber, distinguished guests and ladies and gentlemen, after listening to what Governor Leader said, I've concluded that my words are so valuable this evening, I'm almost speechless. I came here tonight to summon you Democrats to the cause of freedom, the cause of human welfare, and to the cause of peace. And I summon all Americans who believe greatly in these things to join with us. We claim no monopoly on the ideals we assert. They are America's ideals. The victory we seek is not just for a party, it is for a people. But we do claim that this victory will come only to the bold and to the brave, to those who are willing to work to make democracy's ideals come true in the lives of every man, woman, and child in America. Yes. And in the world. This is our democratic goal. This is the victory we seek in November. And I am going to fight for it with everything that I have. And our party is honored that leadership in our cause is shared by a man so widely loved and trusted as Senator Estes Key Faber. But it is not by the candidates that this cause will be either won or lost. Democracy's price is the participation in it of all who believe that it serves their best interests. I join with the President of the United States in urging every American, regardless of his party, to register and to do it now, to do it before it is too late. You know, I read here in Harrisburg this morning that another political campaign was opened yesterday just 40 miles from here. before what the newspaper called a crowd of more than 500 of the grand old party elite. You know, I went to my dictionary, and here is what it says. Elite, a group or body considered or treated as socially superior. Well, well, evidently, Joe Smith didn't do any better in Gettysburg than he did in San Francisco. And for my part, I'm mighty glad to be here tonight to open the 1956 Democratic campaign before 10,000 Pennsylvanians with the whole nation as our invited guests. This is my third visit to Harrisburg in the past 2 years. Each time that I have come here, the crowd gets larger. Just as each month, all across the country, the tide of protest and of hope has risen. And that's why, after generations of Republican rule, the people called on the Democrats to clean up Philadelphia. And that... And that's why, after decades of Republican rule, the governor of Pennsylvania today is a vigorous and gifted young Democrat, George Leader. And that's why, too, the next United States Senator from Pennsylvania will be a Democrat, a dedicated man of noble principle and of demonstrated competence, Joseph Clark. And if I may claim a point of personal privilege, I want to salute tonight your good friend and my campaign manager, that wise and gentle Irishman, Jim Finnegan of Philadelphia. And what is happening here in Pennsylvania is going on in state after state. Just this week, the rising tide burst the ancient dikes in the state of Maine. Now, why is this? I think it's because the fog is rising. Because the fog of half-truths and of amiable complacency has been penetrated, and people perceive at last that all is not well in Washington and in the world. Our Republican friends have been suggesting in one way or another that there are no real issues between the parties. Well, when someone says that the two parties' programs are just about the same, I say that so are two checks signed by different people. The question is, which one can be cashed and which one will bounce? And I say that for 150 years, a check by the Democratic Party written out to the American people has been worth its face value. We say what we mean. We mean what we say, and the record proves it. This is 1956. The 56th year of our century. America has spent 28 of these years under Democratic government and 28 years under Republican government. During those Democratic years, what did we do? We abolished child labor. We commenced unemployment insurance, old age retirement, minimum wages, made collective bargaining work, guaranteed bank deposits. We financed home ownership, started public housing, put a floor under farm prices, set up TVA and REA, protected investors through the Securities Commission, consumers through the Federal Trade Commission, and we lifted the nation from the rubble of bankruptcy and despair to a great plateau of abundance. And And most of all, it was under Democratic leadership that this nation met and defeated the greatest threats to individual liberty and national freedom in modern history. And what did the Republican leadership give us in the 28 years of its leadership? Well, there were some accomplishments, but the comparison is not very flattering. And that's why I say that to get these things done, America will once again turn to Democratic leadership. The Republicans have posed the issues of this campaign in terms of slogans of peace, prosperity, and progress. I pose these issues in terms of facts. The facts of America's unmet human needs, the facts of a revolutionary age, of a revolutionary world in this hydrogen age. Here are some of the facts. In 4 years, 4 years of wealth and abundance, our government has let the shortage of schools and of school teachers get worse. It has done almost nothing to stop the slum cancer which today infects tens of millions of American dwellings. And juvenile delinquency, which breeds in slums and in poor schools, has increased at a frightening rate. We have done nothing to help the lot of the poor and of our older people, and their situation gets worse as the cost of living climbs to the highest point in our history. And we've done mighty little to aid the fight against disease or to make up the shortage of doctors and nurses. We have watched the vice of higher costs and of lower prices close on the helpless farmer whose only defense is that he has done his job too well. And the small businessman is now back to the wall. Instead of turning our natural resources, our rivers and lands and forests to the public good, we have seen them raided for private profit. And the facts of our progress towards peace are even more sobering, it seems to me. The Soviets have advanced, while we have fallen back. Not only in the competition for strength of arms, but even in education. Millions of people have moved further toward the false promises of communism than the true faith in freedom. And why has all of this happened? It has happened because for 4 years now, we have had a government which neither fully understands nor wholly sympathizes with our human needs or the revolution that is sweeping our world. The Republican administration took office on the pledge to make it a businessman's government. Well, that's one pledge they kept. President Eisenhower filled most of the top-ranking offices in his administration with those whose lives have been spent in business and mostly in big business. Then, partly by choice and partly by unhappy necessity, we regret that the president turned over to these men of limited interest and experience still more of the powers of government. Where their interests are involved, cutting taxes for the well-to-do, turning our natural resources over to private companies, chipping away at TVA, and along with Mr. Dixon and Mr. Yates, these men have been highly effective indeed. But where human interests are concerned, the interests of the young and of the old, the worker, the farmer, where the need is to wipe out poverty or to build schools and hospitals, to clear slums, even to distribute the salt vaccine, there no one leads. Now, I respect Mr. Eisenhower's good intentions. I have been accused of undue moderation toward his administration. And certainly the Democrats in Congress have constantly rescued the Republican president from his own party. Everyone shares in the sympathy for the circumstances which have created a part-time presidency. But we cannot understand, and we will not accept, turning the government over to men who work full-time for the wrong people or for a limited group of people. And the plain truth is that this situation would get worse, not better, because what influence the president has with the Republican leaders in Congress has depended on his running again. But from here on, the future of Republican leaders will depend not on Mr. Eisenhower, but the Republican heir apparent, Mr. Nixon. And the vice president seems to sail downwind, no matter which way the wind blows. Now, these, my friends, are stern facts. To ignore them is perilous. They are the reasons America's human needs go today unmet. Nor will they be met so long as the president is not master in his own house. I firmly believe that America does not want to rest on dead center, that it wants fervently to move forward again, to meet these needs, and to live up to the best that is in it. I think America wants to be called to build the schoolrooms and to train the teachers our children so desperately need. I think America wants to be called to clear away the slums and bring basic dignity to millions more. And I think America wants to attack relentlessly the vast realm of human pain and lift from those hit by serious accident or illness at least the added burden of grinding debt. I think America wants to give to the lives of older people the dignity and meaning that they yearn for and that they deserve. As I have in the past, I will lay before you in as full detail as a political campaign permits, proposals for meeting our needs. And we will talk soberly about their cost and the ways and means of approaching them in a responsible manner. Whatever we can do here at home will be meaningless unless the world is such that what we do can endure. When we are spending $40 billion a year for defense, when the peace the Republicans boast about looks more fragile by the moment, when the hydrogen bombs and the guided missiles are multiplying, when communist influence is spreading among restless millions, when we can lose the Cold War without ever firing a shot, then I say that most of all, America is anxious about America, about its peace and its security. It is not enough to pile pact on pact, weapons on weapons, or to totter dangerously from crisis to crisis. There must be a call to war against the poverty, the hunger, the nothingness in people's lives that draws them to communism's false beacon. We must guide the hopes of mankind away from the blind alleys of extreme nationalism or bogus communist internationalism. We must turn them instead to an ideal of partnership between the nations in which disputes are settled by conciliation, not violence, and in which the weapons of death are limited and controlled. We Americans have never been, and we never will be, a nation content just to count today's blessings. We have confidence in ourselves, confidence that we can build what we have to build, that we can grow as we have to grow, and that we can change as we must change, and play our full part in the making of a new America, a better tomorrow for ourselves and for all of mankind. Our plan for 20th century man is not just for his survival, but for his triumph. If I were to attempt to put my political philosophy tonight into a single phrase, it would be this: trust the people. Trust their good sense, their decency, their fortitude, their faith. Trust them with the facts. Trust them with the truth. Trust them with the great decisions. And fix as our guiding star the passion to create a society where people can fulfill their best selves, where no American is held down by race or color, by worldly condition, or by social status from gaining what his character earns him. As an American citizen, as a human being, and as a child of God. So I say to you, my friends, let us be up and doing, probing ceaselessly for solutions of today's problems, and the new ones tomorrow will leave upon our doorstep. And if you share my view, if you share the Democratic view, that this election is a summons to a sleeping giant, then I hope you will join us to make that summons clear and strong on Election Day and to help us march forward toward the new America.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are now watching and listening to the thunderous demonstration which is following tonight's address by Democratic standard bearer Governor Adlai Stevenson, in which he has officially opened his campaign for the presidency of the United States. Also, of course, on tonight's program were Governor George Leader of the state of Pennsylvania and Governor Stevenson's running mate, Senator Estes Kefauver of Tennessee. This, incidentally, is the start of a campaign that is certainly going to carry both of the Democratic candidates into every nook and cranny of the United States, not only via these television and radio appearances, but also through plane and train trips. Incidentally, this demonstration here in Harrisburg is certainly a thrilling one. We're speaking to you, as you undoubtedly know, from the Farm Arena here in Harrisburg, which I am told is just about the largest arena under one roof in the United States. The party of Kefauver and Stevenson arrived in Harrisburg by plane from New York at 1:10 this morning, a very early morning and a very drizzly morning, but there were some 1,000 people, ardent Pennsylvania supporters of the Democratic standard bearers of Stevenson and Kefauver, waiting for the presidential plane as it set down at the airport for the first prop hop. And the word and term prop hop is certainly due to replace the antiquated term of whistle stop during this very, very active 1956 campaign. After their arrival, they were taken to the Executive Mansion as guests.
Appreciate if you put the signs down, the TV cameras.
An aide said that Governor Stevenson spent most of his time working on this first address, the first official address of the 1952 campaign, and judging by the enthusiastic reaction of the crowd here in the arena, it was certainly well worth the effort. Incidentally, you can see that the arena has been decorated with placards inscribed, "Remember Maine." That's not the Maine. That is Maine, the state of Maine. And it's just about time to sign off, and I'd like to remind you folks that if you would like to be part of the victory drive, you can do something. You can do one thing now to help elect Stevenson and Kefauver. You can help pay the heavy costs of carrying their messages to the people between now and November 6th. Just a dollar or two in an envelope and mail it right now to Stevenson Victory Fund, Washington, D.C. That's the Stevenson Victory Fund, Washington, D.C. This program came to you from the arena in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
The leading question and news analysis with Eric Severide were not heard tonight, so that you might hear an address by Adlai E. Stevenson. Mr. Stevenson was introduced by Governor George M. Leader of Pennsylvania. Time for this broadcast was purchased by the Democratic National Committee. Tom O'Brien announced for the committee. This is the CBS Radio Network.